From the Sky News Centre at 5, 9 people have been arrested and 11 officers hurt after violent clashes in Bristol. Police in riot gear fought running battles with crowds after a raid on a squat in the city. Officers say they had to act after squatters planned to target a new Tesco Express which should divided the community. These locals say a peaceful protest quickly turned nasty.
There were massed ranks of riot police.
It was all fairly good-natured until people started sitting down. And then started throwing bottles.
There was a tense atmosphere and, yeah, it didn't feel great. It was a full-on riot.
A group of former members of the Provisional IRA say they killed a police officer in Northern Ireland. In a statement to the Belfast Telegraph newspaper, the group promised to continue the IRA's campaign of violence. Constable Ronan Kerr died 3 weeks ago when a bomb exploded under his car in Omagh. Today, a man's been charged with terrorism offences. Half of the UK's 15-year-old girls have been drunk at least twice. That's almost double the average of other wealthy countries. Research group Demos says British girls find their teenage years much harder than boys. People who update their Facebook or Twitter accounts when they're going on holiday aren't just making their friends jealous. An insurance company is warning it increases their chances of being burgled by highlighting a property will be empty. Neil Lennon says threats to his life won't deter him from continuing as Celtic manager. He and others associated with the club have been targeted by a parcel bomber.
I've had this for 10 years. I don't want to say you get used to it because you never do. It's been with me for my time as a player, my time as a coach, and now my time as a manager. But it's not going to deter me from doing what I want to do.
We're still on course to have the hottest April since records began. As the extended Easter break begins, temperatures reach 24 degrees Celsius at St James's Park in London. Much of the rest of the country is around 20 degrees. Forecasters predict the fine weather will continue into next week. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and on the day Stokes Croft hit the national news over a handful of squatters and an unwanted Tesco Express, with riot police being bussed in from three neighbouring forces and allegations of petrol bombs, we ask, who has more power, Tesco or our elected politicians? Plus, as bored US soldiers film themselves murdering an Afghan teenager, is it time to draw a line under the Afghan war? Joined this week by Labour MP for Bristol East and Shadow Treasury Minister Kerry McCarthy. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Russia and China are kicking up a fuss as NATO military advisers go into Libya. And pilotless drones armed with missiles ply the skies from today. But what does this mean? And what about the use of radioactive uranium tank buster shells? Is this war crimes? And how are Gaddafi's forces or the rebels supposed to surrender to a drone? We hear from Chris Cole of Drone Watch UK and examine shocking revelations about NATO's hidden agenda in Libya. Plus, a Good Friday situation report from the Holy Land, our tensions being stoked up by some religious fanatics of 2011, from the Haifa-born son of a 1940s British civil servant in British-controlled Palestine. Plus, US investment bank Goldman Sachs profits are up this week, way above expectations, but the dollar is doomed. Martin Summers explains the contradiction. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and clear, including bank holiday Monday. Highs of 21 degrees Celsius, sunny and dry. Next week, highs of 17 Celsius, cloudier with some rain towards the end of the week. Next weekend, it's the 30th of April and the 1st of May, highs of 20 Celsius, fairly cloudy with some rain. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. OK, well, time to introduce this week's guest now. I'm joined by Treasury, Shadow Treasury Minister, Kerry McCarthy. Hi, Kerry. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi. Good to be back.
Now, first of all, how did you come to be on Stokes Croft last night? Because you've been making the national news today.
Well, I started seeing reports on Twitter last night, and as it seems to be almost certainly the norm these days is that news always breaks on Twitter before, way before the mainstream media pick up on it, and people were starting to ask, what's happening down there, what's going on, and there were reports about, a big police presence. And after about an hour of seeing this, myself and one of the Labour candidates that's standing in the area decided that we should go down and just sort of see for myself. I mean, I'd seen some of the student protests in London and the protest against education maintenance allowances and some of the policing issues there, and I just thought it was quite important to sort of see what was happening on the ground and what the police operation was like. So we popped down there, was there from about 1 o'clock in the morning till about 3:30.
Now, what did you see? Because what we keep hearing is the potential of Molotov cocktails and allegations of petrol bombs, this kind of thing. Did you see any of that at all?
No, there weren't any petrol bombs. I think that was, that's been the reason given by the police for actually raiding the squat, that they thought there'd been reports from people in the community that there could be an attack on Tesco's. So that's why they went in and raided the squat to try and find evidence of petrol bombs, and then everything else sort of flowed from that. By the time I got, I certainly saw big chunks of concrete. The road was absolutely littered with big chunks of concrete that had been thrown at the police vans and at the police with their riot shields, lots and lots of broken glass and lots of bottles being thrown, and a few things set on fire, but just wheelie bins with fires in them. So there was some behaviour by I wouldn't really call them the protesters, because there were people taking part in sit-down protests. There were people sitting down with their bicycles and playing music and that. And that was all quite peaceful. But I think it was a different group of people that were throwing the missiles. And to be honest, I think it was partly because they'd been drinking.
Now, part of the reason that this is happening is because this Tesco's... there's been big petitions and things locally saying they don't want the Tesco's, yet it's gone ahead anyway. Yeah. So who's more powerful? You politicians, who are supposed to decide these things, or the Tesco's themselves? Can they go anywhere they want?
Well, the planning process is a quasi-judicial process, which means you're not meant to make decisions on political grounds. If you go back to the beginning of this, I think the problem was when this used to be a comedy club, and they applied for change of use to retail premises, and it wasn't clear that it was Tesco's that wanted that change of use. It was put in, anonymously or under another name.
No, just for a grocer's of some sort, not rather than saying it was Tesco's.
Yeah, just saying it was retail use. And that went through, I think actually it was the ward councillor, for Ashley Ward, who was the executive member for planning at the time, just rubber stamped it without referring it to planning committee. So once that decision's been made for change of use, the only grounds on which you could object to it being Tesco's would be whether there were licensing issues, selling alcohol late at night, what the signage is like, whether it would attract too much traffic. And those criteria were all met by Tesco's. So if it had then been turned down by people on the planning committee on sort of spurious grounds, Tesco's, having bags of money behind them, would have taken it to appeal. Council would have spent lots of money on lawyers defending something that they wouldn't have won. So really, it was that decision to change the use that opened the doors for Tesco's. What I think a lot of people would think is that if you have a situation where 93% of the local population say they don't want it to be a Tesco's, and you've got the government banging on about its localism agenda, and it's all meant to be about devolving power down to local people, What you actually find is that what was floated in the budget by George Osborne is they're going to, it's part of this idea of fostering private sector growth by actually speeding up the planning process, making it much easier for developers to get planning permission. And I've already asked questions about how does that square. On the one hand, you're saying full steam ahead for developers. On the other hand, you've got this supposed localism agenda that Eric Pickles is promoting that is saying it's up to local people to decide what they want. Well, how is that going to work in practice? It seems to me that it's a green light for companies like Tesco's, and if they were serious about localism, they would allow local communities to say, we can't object to it on traffic grounds or licensing grounds or whatever, we just don't want it. And they would be listened to, but that's certainly not the case at the moment. So your question was who's more powerful, Tesco's or the politicians? I mean, certainly in this instance, Tesco's had the upper hand.
Now, the problem is actually, of course, that you've got local people being and local retailers being squeezed out by Tesco's. All other parts of the country, we've got countless Tesco's across Bristol and other cities. ultimately, is the whole world going to become a Tescopoly and the Tesco's going to be the only people retailing groceries?
Well, I think they were saying on Twitter last night there were 31 Tescos in Bristol, and I think that may actually be an underestimate, because I know certainly I live in Redcliffe, and I think I can count 6 or 7 that are within 10 minutes walk of my house. There's a new one just opened up in Victoria Street, and it is having a knock-on effect. There's a co-op store that's just around the corner from me that is obviously being hit by Tesco's being, you know, open and cheaper and more range of products. And yeah, I think that some of the new Tesco Expresses that are opening up are so small they are actually corner shops rather than mini supermarkets. And yeah, I think you may well see the day when virtually all shops are part of the Tesco conglomerate, and I'm not sure that's what people want.
Also, last night, there's been some criticism of the policing. What sort of scale was it on? What did you see?
Well, I think the starting point would be this was quite a small group of people anyway. There were only about, I'd say, 300 people out on the streets. It's said that the police numbered about 160, so that's a lot considering, you know, most of the people who were there, I'd say, were bystanders that were taking photographs, or that, you know, they're wandering through on
their
way back.
People like you that have got texts,
like me,
or
yeah, whatever, yeah, yeah. So, you know, the number of people that were actively involved in protesting, either, you know, doing the sit down protests or putting their bicycles down or whatever, and the people who were throwing things, you know, I think was a very small number. So, it does seem that there was a very heavy police presence considering what was happening. And, you know, there's always an issue in this case of, you know, does the heavy police presence calm things down, or does it actually sort of inflame the situation? There were instances where, you know, the police were sort of steaming into a crowd of people sitting down on the floor, or someone I was with was hit with a truncheon, police van came up on the pavement and people were wedged against the shop window. There were things like that, you know, the use of dogs, there were a couple of horses there as well.
I mean, did you see any of those sort of situations like the Richard Tomlinson syndrome, where someone is sort of just a spectator, bystanding, who is then caught up in it somehow?
Yeah, well, certainly the colleague I was with who was hit with a truncheon, that was a policeman lashing out at somebody else, and then him, and he was just standing there, I think he was taking a photograph. But I saw a photographer who was taking a picture of, there were two people playing the saxophone on top of the bus shelter outside the flat, so you've got graffiti covered flats, two people up on the bus shelter playing saxophone, quite a photo, and a policeman just walked over and knocked him over. Yeah, he was crouched down on the ground taking the picture, policeman knocked him over, and then about 2 minutes later did the same again, which seemed completely, you know, pointless and unreasonable and inflammatory. Certainly, you know, at one point we had to hide in a doorway to a shop because suddenly all these police surged forward, and we'd been quite, you know, I was quite careful to keep quite a distance from what was happening. It's very difficult in those circumstances to avoid that. You know, quite a lot of police vans whizzing around as well, and I think at various points people were caught up. And the other thing was, you know, well, we were at some distance behind the police vans, but then everybody lobbing things at the police vans. They were missing the police vans and hitting the people who were standing there peacefully the other side. So, you know, we were ducking broken glass and everything. So, yeah, it was, you know, I was sort of trying to keep out of the way but get close enough to actually usefully be able to see what was going on, but it was quite frightening at times.
Now, one of the things I've heard on Radio Bristol today is one of the houses was raided for apparently petrol bombs inside. Mm. And there were apparently only 4 people in there, as we were told, but the residents themselves were talking on the radio afterwards. I would have thought if the police had found these petrol bombs, they would have arrested the people in the building.
Well, that's what we're I bumped into the chief constable in Stokescroft earlier today, and he was saying, you know, because originally it was being reported, and it had been in the Bristol Evening Post yesterday, that the protesters were going to be evicted, the squatters were going to be evicted. And it did seem to me bizarre that you would evict squatters, you know, in the early hours of evening when there's lots of people out drinking and things like that. So it turns out it wasn't that, it was, you know, evidence-led in terms of these petrol bombs that people in the community had reported, seeing things being carried in and out. So the police felt that they had to act. Like you say, I mean, I think that, you know, it's up to the police now to sort of provide evidence for that and sort of justification of their actions. Yes, certainly that would be the police. That is what the police are saying, is that they had what they felt was strong evidence that there was potentially a petrol bomb attack on Tesco's going to happen that evening, and that's why they had to intervene when they did.
Now, also joined by old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, can you tell us what's going on with Tesco's? Are they really going to slowly take over the country? Because what they're doing is, essentially, what they used to do was have these big out-of-town supermarkets. They've now realised there's another grocery market, and that is these little sort of replacing these family-owned corner shops.
Well, I think Kerry pretty much summed it up earlier. I mean, the planning law in Britain has always favoured developers. If you think about it, we've got a free market economy, and, you know, unless there is a good reason for you not to do something, you are allowed to do it. And in a way, you can see why the rules are set in that way. But there is a contradiction between the localism agenda that the government are pushing and the idea that developers should be allowed to get through what they want quicker.
But earlier this week, Tesco's reported profits of $3.5 billion.
Oh, yeah, but Tesco...
How can a small... You know these little corner shops, how can anybody compete with that kind of financial muscle?
Well, you can't. I mean, ultimately, what happens in all free markets, most free markets, is conglomeration and monopolisation. That's why free market theory breaks down, because in actual fact, through the free market usually leads to imperfect competition and oligopoly. And basically, you know, the big supermarkets will eventually control everything unless they are regulated. Now, that would mean changes in planning law, for example. You might want to change planning law to make it more difficult for supermarkets to operate and easier for small people to operate. So like farming, for example, you might want to encourage small farmers rather than big farmers, but that would require changes in common agricultural policy and so on. But we're a long way away from that. I mean, the philosophy of governments in this country, Labour or Conservative, has usually been let business do what it wants. I mean, that goes back to the 19th century, when Bristol was run by what's called the shopocracy.
Now, for the time being, Tesco Express on Soaks Croft is closed, but the anti-Tesco Express movement in and around the area is not just against Tesco. 5 minutes walks down towards the Bear Pit on the west side of the road, several of the peaceful campaigners have been running something called a free shop, a busy charity shop for donations only. It looks likely to be evicted though soon, because the Hong Kong and Isle of Man registered company that left the shop derelict for nearly 20 years has got a possession order. I spoke to Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action, who's been helping manage the free shop further down Stokes Croft for 2 years now, and he talks about how he sees an alternative to the Tescopoly.
My name's Ben Ritchie. We're in the Emporium Art Gallery next to the Bristol Free Shop on Stokes Croft. The free shop, first of all, recycles unwanted goods, things that people don't want but still feel there might be a use for, and also, of course, it provides goods at no cost to those who might otherwise not be able to afford them.
But why free? I mean, from even in charity shops, you get charged a little something for second-hand goods.
Well, this is part of the free economy, the whole idea being that we can gradually liberate more and more of our lives away from the use of money by the community getting together and providing the needs and goods that it requires to function without intermediaries like money.
We're always going to need money, so what's the point of this?
It's surprising, but prior to Thatcherism, there was an awful lot of British society was on the point of abolishing money. A lot of public transport was subsidised. There was a National Health Service which wasn't under threat. Schools were free. University was free. You could see that you could make most of the necessities of life completely free, because people are quite happy to provide work and services if they know their basic needs are going to be met by the community.
Because you haven't been selling things, you haven't got enough money to pay rent or whatever for the building, it's a squatted building, and now the owners are going to take it back off you, so it's not really sustainable, is it, to do a free shop if you're going to lose it?
In itself, the free shop is sustainable. Obviously, under this society, private property reigns, and the law will be on the side of the private developer. But in this particular case, the judge did make the point that he doesn't expect to see the premises back in court again, and that the owner should make every effort to make use of the building, which has been empty since 1992.
So how long has the free shop itself been going?
It's been running now for over 2 years. We've been in operation since January of the year before. It's been constantly busy since then.
What sort of things are you giving away?
You've got mainly books, clothes, musical instruments, furniture, all household items, tools, paint, anything that people think is useful for the rest of the community.
So how long is the shop going to be open? Because we hear that you've been to court and it now looks like there's going to be an eviction.
Well, how long's a piece of string? We intend to keep going. We are in negotiation with the owner. We hope they're going to be sensible enough to accept an offer that we can afford, either of renting or of buying the property, because we think they can't sell it. It's virtually derelict. It's a Grade 2 listed building. They can't develop from the ground up. So they've got extreme constraints on what they can do with the building. They've done nothing so far. So why don't they just accept that we're the best people to run it, provide a service to the community, and keep their property going for them?
Just up the road, we've had a Tesco Express open, famously, with a little protest camp outside. Surely that's the way of the future, not the free shop, which can't actually pay the rent.
The thing about Tesco's is that they're incredibly unpopular. Although they dominate 40% of the retail market of Britain, they aren't the future, because people don't really want everything to be dominated by one giant monopoly, which dictates what they eat, what they wear, what they can get for their household goods. And we hope that the free shop's the future, the economy based on the gift rather than on an exchange. In other words, a really free society, a communist society, if you like, or an anarchist society, is the way forward.
That was Ben Ritchie from Bristol Housing Action talking to me yesterday before all the riots and things like that. Let's come to you first, Martin. The idea of anarchists and communists and society without money, is this just totally pie in the sky?
It's not totally pie in the sky, but there's a long way to go before any of those things become truly possible, let's put it that way.
Well, in a way, they're doing it with the free shop, aren't they? There's actually lots of young, for example, young mums who are trying to get
I understand that children's clothes are one of the things that's been most successful, because people hand them in and then younger children can come and get them. And you know, I think it's great that people are prepared to experiment with different ways of doing things. And the whole development of Stokes Croft, you know, the development of the what used to be Hamilton House, the vision that George Ferguson has for that area.
You got the People's Republic of Stokes.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that it should be improved without being gentrified. I think he's actually inspired a whole generation of young people there with his vision. And, you know, I would like to see Stokes Croft as a kind of, you know, bohemian centre for Bristol. You know, they're attracting tourists, for example. People in the canteen, lots of them are foreign tourists who would never come to Stokes Croft normally, but the area is beginning to get an ambiance, you know, and I think there's a lot of positive things going on down there.
But Kerry, this hard idea of a sort of bohemian part of town, in a way, they've done what they said they'd do, because Tesco's has only been open about a week and now it's been shut down.
Well, I think it remains to be seen what happens to Tesco's now. I mean, certainly I don't think it'll be opening in the next few days, and they'd obviously be concerned for the safety of staff and whether the place would just get trashed again if it did open up. So I think Tesco's have got a decision to make on that front. You know, I think the sort of things like the free shop, but yeah, are fine. They're great if people want to do that. I don't think it's the sort of thing that can operate on a particularly big scale, or as like Martin says, you know, it'd be something that would take many, many years to evolve. But I certainly, again, on, you know, on the children's clothes front, I know that there's quite a lot of online sites that do those similar sort of swaps, and you know, I think it's great if that sort of project can be made to work. And you also get it with when people have got allotments, you know, trade in things that they've grown. Yeah, that's fine, that's good, that's good community spirit. Dangerously close to the big society, I'd say, but I don't think it's the answer to everything. And what it almost seems in Bristol is you've got it's becoming slightly polarised, because on the one hand you've got the big chains and everywhere's either a Starbucks or a Tesco Express, and then you've got these lovely little community projects, and it's the areas that are really suffering. For example, you know, I represent places like Brislington, where those little high streets that have maybe got 10 or 15 shops, they've all just become takeaways, and, you know, the post office has closed down, the greengrocers has closed down, and there's very little in those neighbourhoods. And what you tend to see is people come in, set up something like a florist and go out of business a year later, and then somebody else comes in with a cake shop and it goes out of business. And I think we really need to look at how we revitalise those communities as well, which aren't as bohemian as Stokes Croft, perhaps don't have as much community involvement, but, you know, they are valued by local people.
Martin, are we going to see more of this in the future?
More of what?
This kind of action that we've seen, you know, people really, I suppose, trying to stop the big corporations coming in as local businesses.
I think this is very much a product of a younger generation's rebellion against corporate the corporate state. And I think with the economy in the state it's in, young people in quite an angry mood. We saw what happened at the end of last year with the student demonstrations. I think, you know, the establishment are in for a bit of a rough ride from this generation, and frankly, I'm rather proud of them.
Okay, well, Kerry, you're also a Shadow Treasury Minister, aren't you? Can you just tell us what that actually means? What is a Shadow Treasury Minister? It sounds very grand.
there's five of us in the Shadow Treasury team. And obviously, you've got Ed Balls as the Shadow Chancellor and Angela Eagle as Chief Secretary to the Treasury. So they're the two that are Cabinet members. And then there's three of us that, if you like, do the techie and obscure things. So the thing is in Parliament, I mean, you see the big debates that go on in the chamber, like the budget debate, but there's actually a lot of stuff that's done through secondary legislation, European standing committees scrutinise some of the European stuff. So within my portfolio, which is Shadow Economic Secretary, I cover things like excise duties, so alcohol duties, fuel duties. I cover green taxation. I cover the EU budget for my sins, which is obviously quite topical at the moment, and things like the child poverty agenda, which is quite important because the government has just published its child poverty strategy, and there's all sorts of signs that it's rowing back on actually a commitment to take action on that. So it basically, it means that when the government is putting forward legislation, you have the government minister in the Economic Secretary to the Treasury presenting something to a committee, and I'll be the one that is standing up challenging her.
So what this EU budget, I think many people will be rather annoyed to hear that the EU budget is going up. I think it's in its something like 7%.
There was a lot of posturing by David Cameron that there wasn't, you know, we wouldn't be supporting an increase. They wanted a freeze in the budget. Then there was a concession where it was coming out, sort of a midway mark. Certainly the Conservative backbenchers are very, very, I mean, it's actually strange because although it's a much younger Conservative Party in Parliament, the new ones are more Eurosceptic, if you like, than the old guard. And particularly at a time when this country's having to make cuts, you know, to see that there's actually an increase in EU spending, you know, I think on both sides of the chamber we're unhappy with that, but particularly the Tory Eurosceptics are very unhappy, and very unhappy with their front bench for not being able to make headway and not being able to get a freeze in Europe.
You're in alliance with these young Tories now, are you?
Well, no, I mean, yeah, I think we're coming at it from a different angle, because they come at it from the angle that all EU spending is evil. And it's quite, I mean, I did an European committee the other day, and Jacob Rees-Mogg, who's my neighbour in North East Somerset, he stood up and denounced the EU as socialism, trying to inflict socialism on this country, whereas Kelvin Hopkins, who used to be my MP when I lived in Luton on the Labour side, he thinks that the EU is a capitalist conspiracy against the working classes. So the Eurosceptics is all coming at it from slightly different angles. But, you know, I mean, our view would be that the EU does some valuable stuff, but there is waste. Failed again, I think, for the 17th year in a row to sign off the accounts to show that it had all been spent wisely and well. Things like the common agricultural policy, you know, has massive need of reform, and it's been on the agenda for a long time.
Well, isn't this the problem with the EU? The main problem is that most of the decisions made by the European Commission, none of whom are elected, and almost all of whom are failed politicians who've been kicked out by the public at some point in the past.
Well, I don't think that's quite the case, but the problem is, you wade through huge numbers of documents and, you know, strategy documents and memorandums and all this sort of thing, and it is very difficult. It's very opaque, the European budget process, and I don't think there is that transparency and accountability there that we need to have. Lots of things are hidden behind obscure sounding programme titles, I do think there is a need for reform, but at the same time, I don't think that is a reason to say the whole EU project is a failure, and that there aren't good things that come from working together, and particularly with the accession countries coming in. I mean, there does need to be an element of redistribution within the countries.
But,
so that
but
they
don't
can
you think that the Commission, which is the central decision-making body on the EU, has to be elected to have any credibility?
I'm not sure. I mean, you have the Council of Ministers as well, you know, which is our ministers going over, and ministers, their counterparts from other countries, make some decisions. You've obviously got the elected European Parliament. If you had elected commissioners, I mean, how many people can name their MEPs in this country? You know, I'd struggle. You know, I know the UKIP guy, I think, and that's about it. And you know, I'm a politician, so you know, I'm not sure that that's necessarily the answer. I think, you know, there is a mechanism through the Council of Ministers and through the European Parliament to have those checks on what the Commission's doing. But it, you know, it's. In some ways, it's bureaucratic through necessity, because when you're trying to bring lots of different countries together, you know, there has got to be ways of documenting it, and you know, you do end up with government by committee. But at the same time, I do think that there are, you know, the processes could be massively simplified, and there could be a lot more public accountability. And it's a bit difficult to explain without sort of start getting into all the jargon about all the way the different systems work. But it's, you know, I've been looking at the sort of things like the 2020 strategy, and it's just absolutely full of jargon. And I think people, you know, there's no way that you can sell that to the British public, because it's just, you know, totally obscure stuff.
So, Martin, you're sitting next to the shadow, one of the shadow Treasury team. If you were Chancellor, or if you were an advisor to the Chancellor, what would you be advising right now, since we seem to be going into this double-dip recession?
U-turn.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean exactly?
It's what Edward Heath did in the 70s when he realised that his cuts policy was going to crash the economy. He turned and did something more sensible.
Basically,
they shouldn't be cutting in the way that they are.
Yeah.
I mean, I know the front bench position on the Labour side is that they should be cutting, but not so hard. I think if they crash the economy, we're out of that game, and we're not talking about cuts at all. And of course, what the Tories will do if they crash, and don't forget the deficit is increasing as we speak. Tick, tick, tick. It's going up, because that's what happens.
But
when
Martin, if we start spending, that deficit is going to go up even further.
Not necessarily. If you saw the growth that the Labour government bequeathed to the Tory government. Has dwindled.
It's a tiny little bit of growth.
Yes, I know, but the fact was there was some growth, and without growth in the economy, your deficit will increase, and you fall into the hole that Ireland, Greece and Portugal have fallen into, that the more you cut, the bigger your deficit gets, the more you cut, and it's just a vicious circle downwards. Mm-hmm. We haven't got there yet, but I'm afraid George Osborne is steering us straight into it. When he gets there, Standard & Poor's, and the ratings agencies are already suggesting that British debt may be downgraded. I suspect that may happen before the end of the year, and at that point it's going to be like Black Wednesday for the Tories, because they've bet the farm on being able to cut the deficit by cutting public expenditure. If they end up increasing the deficit, I think the bond market will have them for tea.
So, Kerry, which way are the Labour front bench going at the moment? Is it likely to be a little bit of cuts, no cuts, or spending even?
Yeah. Well, as Martin said, our strategy was very much, you know, when the country was hit by the global financial crisis, that it's something that I think, and Martin will correct me if I'm wrong, that Keynes calls the paradigm of thrift or something like that. Paradox of thrift, yeah. Where when people, when the private sector is hit and they stop spending money, the public sector has to step in and start spending to keep that economic growth growing. And we did see that that was starting to work. You know, the country avoided going into depression and was coming out, and was, you know, the economic indicators were looking fairly positive. Now what you've had is the government pulling the rug from under that, slashing the public sector, and as Martin says, that just plunges you back into recession. It's going to be very difficult to dig our way out of that. Now, the Labour front bench view, you know, I think what is important, you know, our stance was that it was far too hard and harsh to seek to eliminate the deficit within 4 years, and we should maybe go for halving it within 4 years. But it was always with a view to what the economic situation was. So, for example, we said there shouldn't be any spending cuts until this coming financial year, because the economy wasn't sufficiently out of recession. And it's something that you have to keep an eye on, as, you know, it's ridiculous to sort of carve in stone, we are going to do this for the next 4 years, if the economic indicators then show that the country is, you know, because it could be hit by factors in other countries or all sorts of things. If it looks like the country is going back into recession, well, any intelligent chancellor or shadow chancellor would adapt their policies accordingly, because that is what you do as an economist.
It's like driving a car. You can't presume that you're going to know what's around the next bend. So you keep your eyes open, and you make sure you've got your foot on the brake and on the accelerator.
So, Kerry, we're going to start. Would we start spending if you know, if Labour were in right now? Would we be now spending? Have we come to the point where you think something needs to be done, that the private sector simply isn't going to pick up on its own?
Well, I think there are areas in which we need to spend. I mean, one of the things that Labour said is that we'd repeat the banker's bonus tax this year, and one of the things we would spend some of that money on is a boost to the construction sector and build more homes. And that was something that again was set in train when we were last in when we were in government, because you know that is you know a fantastic way of actually creating jobs and you know and a knock-on effect throughout the supply chain for you know, because with homes it's not just the bricklayers, it's everybody else that supplies.
But the bankers are going to take off, aren't they?
They threatened it.
Yeah, you know, I was on the Treasury Select Committee when I first got elected to Parliament, and it's something that we don't make enough of, the fact that the Conservatives on that committee and the Conservatives in the House of Commons, their constant mantra was we're taxing too much and regulating too much, and we ought to be like Ireland, because all the banks were going over to Ireland. And actually, it was only the back office functions of the banks that really went there, because the expertise on the traders and the real rocket scientists were based in England. There are several reasons why banks choose to be based in the UK, mainly because of the expertise, because of certain cultural things about living here, about the language, and so on. I don't think the tax regime in itself, it obviously depends what other countries do, but other countries aren't particularly welcoming to those banks, and I don't think it's as simple as saying that they would just they're always going to threaten to do it. You know, you always get companies saying, if corporation tax doesn't come down, we're going to move our things abroad. It's a bit of a game of bluff, but I don't think... you might get some of the hedge funds fleeing the country, and some people might say that's not necessarily a bad thing. But I think the mood on a global level is for tougher regulation and cracking down on some of the more speculative activities of banks. So I don't necessarily think there are other countries that would think it was a wonderful opportunity to sort of deregulate and have low taxes and have all the banks flood there. Well, I've seen what's happened in Ireland when they did that.
Well, what about the public? Our massive shareholding now in these British banks like Lloyds, for a long time, when Labour was in power, when you were in power, you did nothing about that. And now the Conservatives are sort of twiddling their thumbs. The public are getting fed up with our politicians, aren't they? Because we've got a massive stake in these banks and we should be forcing them to lend, shouldn't we?
I think there's several issues. One is about the remuneration levels and the amount of bonuses they're paying. And one of the things that the government was going to do was to have far more transparency. But I think all it is the top five earners in a company now have to declare how much they're earning. And so the chief executives or whatever, but not necessarily the traders that are making huge amounts of money. And the traders are actually the ones that are gambling the most with the firm's money. So there's that issue. But then there's also... the Project Merlin thing, which was about the government review trying to get banks to lend more. And really, it's a complete damp squib, because it's making all the right noises saying, yes, banks should lend to small businesses, they should play a role in supporting the economy. It's not happening in practice. And they actually, there's neither a carrot nor a stick to make them do it. There's no incentives being given for the banks to do that, and there's no penalties if they don't do it. It's just, we would like you to do this and please cooperate. So it's fairly woolly stuff, it has to be said, and I'm sure lots of people think that there should be more being done to make them lend.
Yes, but you see, it's a bit rich coming from you, because why didn't you do something when Labour was in power?
Well, I think it was a different political climate until a few years ago, and I think, Ed Balls and Gordon Brown as well, I think, have accepted that we, the light touch regulation on the bank, it was too much light touch regulation. But, we had...
it's almost like stroking them, isn't it? you lovely banks.
But, we had the first 10 years of the Labour government, things seemed, economic growth, economic stability. It wasn't identified that there was a problem. Companies were able to access finance. It wasn't a problem. It was only when the global financial crisis hit that these issues sort of got on the political agenda. And yes, perhaps we should have done something during a more benign economic time, but yeah, that's the thing about politics, isn't it? You learn lessons from events.
Well, I hope so, yeah. Because it seems like the banks are one step ahead of the politicians. Martin, anyway, what are your thoughts about, you know, anything that could be done?
Well, one of the things
about,
you've got
getting banks to sort of do what the public wants, rather.
Well, one of the things you've got to take into account is that banks are not charities, and looking at the economic situation, they're quite rationally looking at small businesses saying, we're not going to lend you any money because you're going to go bust. So it's the overall macroeconomic environment that determines the level of investment. Yeah, you can't. I mean, why do we allocate resources for investment through a private banking system? That's a question. Maybe we have to move towards the government allocating investment funds. Sounds radical, but in fact, that's what we used to do from the 1940s to the 1970s. Nationalised industries. The government, in fact, was involved in lots of capital formation without using private banks at all. And I think the question is being asked all over the world, what are private banks for? And the answer is becoming more and more clear to people. Perhaps we don't need a private banking system at all. We will see as we go forward. You see, things like this don't change easily. The culture of capitalism, the culture of private finance is ingrained in the British psyche over 200 years. And the idea of giving it up seems intolerable and unthinkable. But we're going into dangerous times and radical measures may be needed. I actually look to the Conservative government, potentially, to be very heavy duty on the city. Cameron could have chosen to play it that way. Mm. Yeah? And it would have been better coming from the Conservatives than from Labour. Mm. Labour have always had a kind of, pretty fraught relationship with the city. I remember Brian Gould when he was in the early 80s when he was, he was one of the architects of New Labour, and when John Smith went on the prawn cocktail offensive to talk to the City of London, Gould basically said, if we're not prepared, meaning the Labour Party, to take on the City of London, then we're all wasting our time. And John Smith was leading the party towards an accommodation with the city, and at that point Gould resigned and went to be an academic in New Zealand. I think that was a missed chance. I think Gould had identified quite clearly, and that was in the 80s, the big bang in the 80s was silly, really, but we've not been able to reverse it, and a lot of these financial reforms that have been forced down our throat over a generation have actually turned out to be disastrous. And there were reasons why, for example, casino banking was separated from retail banking. They were put in place in the 30s to prevent the kind of crisis that's happened, and we used to know how to manage big finance. We forgot about it.
Okay, Kerry, I'll give you the final word on this. What can you say to convince us that the politicians are actually getting ahead of the game and are going to take on the private banks and tell them what to do if necessary?
Well, the other thing we've got, we had the Merlin Review, which was about bank lending. We've got the Vickers Review, which has just come out, which is about regulation. And there will be not just legislation coming through about how we reform the regulatory system, but we've managed to persuade the government that there ought to be pre-legislative scrutiny, which basically means that it's, at the moment we're seeing a lot of legislation being rushed through Parliament very, very quickly. I mean, with the NHS changes that are going through at the moment, it was almost like halfway through Parliament before people even realised what the consequences were. So we've asked for pre-legislative scrutiny, which means that a lot of the detail would be thrashed out and a lot of the debate had before it's really brought before Parliament. We'll certainly be making our views known on, toughening up regulation and what the role of the bank should be. One of the other things, and I'm sure Martin would be keen on this, is looking at things like the mutual model. So whether we support the remutualisation of Northern Rock, you've got things like a small scale credit union movement.
What is this mutual thing? What is a mutual?
So when it's actually owned by, in the same way that the building societies, before they were all sold off to shareholders, it's actually owned by the people that have got accounts
with
the
depositors.
The depositors, yeah. They tend to, wouldn't get involved in the more speculative activity, but you also don't have this scenario where they're making absolutely huge profits for the benefit of the shareholders. And that's something we'd be keen to consider. I think one of the things, actually, I mean, Martin said that you know, David Cameron, the Conservatives, were better placed to push for reform to the banks. Of course, what happened when Vince Cable was given the job of Secretary of State for Business, Innovation and Skills, he thought that he'd been given the role of sorting out the banks. He actually said publicly that he was looking forward to doing that, and then it turns out that it'd been taken away from him and given to somebody else. So, you know, I think that Vince Cable, you know, was somebody who expressed very strong views about this when he was in opposition, and he was actually in some ways seen as the sort of sensible voice of moderation on it, and he needs to speak up now because, you know, Labour is not in government, and the way to persuade the current government to do things is for people within their own ranks to put some influence on them.
Okay, well, on to our next story, and we've also got coming up with the local elections in about a week and a half's time. We've also got this AV referendum. Do we vote yes or do we vote no? Martin, do you want to go first?
On AV?
Yeah.
Well, I believe in AV. I told a story when I was debating this with Charlotte Leslie the other week about New Zealand. In New Zealand in 1980, they voted Labour to keep out Thatcherite policies. They've got a fantastic Labour tradition in New Zealand. They've started building a welfare state in 1936, not 1945. And the Labour activists were horrified to find, by having voted for a Labour government, that they were going to get things like a privatised railway from a Labour government. And they just basically said, we're not having that. Jim Anderton split from the Labour Party, formed something called New Labour, paradoxically enough. They forced a referendum on PR. They then won that referendum. They then had a follow-on election in which the Labour Party formed an alliance with the Greens and the Maori Nationalists and renationalised the railways. And PR was seen in by the New Zealand Labour activists as a way of disciplining their own leadership and preventing them from basically doing silly things like deregulating the banks.
Now, Kerry, this is a bit of a halfway house between the present first-past-the-post system and the PR system. What's your view on AV?
I'm not massively enthusiastic about it because I don't think it... The trouble is when you look at any form of electoral reform is that there doesn't seem to be a perfect system. So I accept that, I'll be voting yes, and I accept that there are... I think there was a real issue with, particularly in the last parliament, there was a lot of disillusion with MPs, there were things like the expenses scandal, and a lot of, the fact that some people have always felt that their vote was wasted if they lived in a safe seat, I think that, was thrown into, became more important because of the disillusionment. So,
because one of the things that was in the Evening Post earlier this week was that actually this may threaten Dawn Primorolo's safe seat. That was one of the commentators was saying that, she's had a safe seat for many years and that AV may threaten that.
Well, it's very, very difficult to judge, particularly, and I think, it is... At least if people would feel that they could vote for the party they wanted to rather than... I know a lot of people last time, for example, who lived in Conservative seats where they voted... would like to have voted Labour but voted Lib Dem to try to keep the Tories out. That's just one example. I think in the past you could probably... There was this assumption that AV would be harmful to the Conservatives more than anyone because Labour and Liberal votes would tend to switch amongst each other because they were both seen as parties of the left. I don't actually think that's really been the case in the South West anyway. I think South West Liberal voters are probably more right-wing than Liberal Democrat voters in inner-city places like Bristol West. But now, I don't think anybody's quite sure where what happened to the Liberal Democrat vote. So it's very difficult to predict. Well, I've seen all sorts of different calculations done as to what the impact would be on constituencies across the country if AV was brought in. I think the thing is to put that to one side and rather be looking at who would gain and who would lose, try to look at it from the fundamental principles of what is fairer. And I do think it's a bit fairer because it does give people more of a say and being able to vote for the party they really want to, but then not feeling that vote for a minority party is wasted. I have to say, I think both the campaigns have been pretty abysmal, the yes side and the no side. I don't think that either side has done a very good job of explaining the virtues of their preferred system. And I do worry that we're very, very close to the referendum date now. And it's only just in the last week that people have started coming up to me And saying, what is this AV thing all about? I don't think the country is ready to make the decision. I think the turnout will be very low and it'll be on quite a poorly informed basis. And I think, you know, I worry that, you know, do you have a mandate for electoral reform if, you know, a small percentage of people vote for it?
Well, let's try and inform people now a bit. And it's very similar. In fact, the voting form, the piece of paper, is identical to the first past the post system. It's just that rather than marking one cross on the voting slip, you get to mark 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and down in a descending order. Mm. So you've got a first preference, a second preference, a third preference. And then, if there's no overall winner, once all those votes are counted, the one with the least votes, all of those votes, the second preference is then taken and shared out amongst the other voting systems. So yeah. Well, the one thing it does seem to get rid of, which I like, is the idea that you have to do tactical voting. In other words, voting for a party you don't actually like in order to stop somebody getting in, as you were saying earlier on. Anyway, so I hope that's helped explain things a little bit. And on to our next story. Earlier this month, horrific pictures were released of apparently bored American soldiers kidnapping and murdering a teenage son of an Afghan tribal leader. The story appeared in Bild Zeitung in Germany and Rolling Stone magazine in the US, but received very little coverage here in Britain, except an article in the Daily Mirror. It was, however, discussed by Ben Makowitz, Wes Clark and Michael Schur on US TV show The Young Turks, which we'll have a listen to now.
A piece about the 3rd Battalion Bravo Company in Afghanistan. He calls them the kill team. These guys apparently, on more than one occasion, sought out Afghan citizens to murder, to get there, to get a kill in. Quickly, your first reaction before we show you some of the video and pictures from this so you get an idea. Mainly, you should go to Rolling Stone to watch it because I don't even want to get to the...
My first reaction when I read it last night?
Yeah.
They should hang those guys. They should execute them by firing squad or whatever Leavenworth says. The guys responsible for it, they're murderers. There's no other word for it.
They are prosecuting, I believe, 5 lower-level guys. Guys involved in it, clearly. One of them,
they should also.
One of them admitted it, gave an interview, and he seems particularly unremorseful.
Their lieutenant should be court-martialed. Their company commander should be relieved and probably court-martialed as well. You don't have that stuff going on, and those guys don't know about it. They've been living with their soldiers.
Okay. Let's take a look at some of the photos. Apparently a 15-year-old kid that they have admitted, these guys, that they sought out because they wanted to kill someone because they had been bored, that they wanted to kill. And the pictures, they're gruesome. They come and set this kid up, then the guys hide behind a wall, throw a grenade at him, and then start shooting, and shot him any number of times, and of course killed him. And then the kid's dead, obviously, and then they do what they...
It's like the village chief's son.
Yeah, well, then they
who was cooperating with them, and they'd just spoken to him.
And right. Not only that, he identified the kid. They brought him over to identify the kid, and he said, oh, my God, that's my son, and of course, broke down.
In the military report, it says...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The father was upset.
That was how, you know, in the army parlance, the father was upset.
Part of it, of course, is not just the killing, but then the taking photos, which violates rules, passing them around, and the celebration of this. There's another instance later in the story where they do the same to an older guy, again, perhaps a farmer, but a guy who was no threat, waving, smiling, no threat at all. Same thing, hiding behind a wall. The guys were worried that they might get hit with their own gunfire and with the exploding grenade. They throw the grenade, and then they shoot him, and then they plant a grenade on
him. And they're also, in the order, they're also cutting off people's fingers and carrying them around with it. It's sick, dude. Yeah, it's sick.
The sergeant is, cutting people's fingers off and celebrating it and then keeping the fingers, and they're passing them around like trophies. And they get
as they're saying, oh, these people are barbarians. Oh, check out this finger I got.
Yeah.
It's like, I think, honestly, and I know a lot of our viewers are anti-death penalty and stuff, but I'm not. And if you're a murderer like that, you should hang.
That was the US show, The Young Turks, Ben Makowitz, Wes Clark and Michael Schur discussing some horrific pictures taken by US soldiers in Afghanistan. Now, these are supposedly bored American soldiers, Kerry McCarthy, Labour MP for East Bristol. Is it time to just get out of Afghanistan if this is the kind of thing that's going on? Because we're not winning hearts and minds like this, are we?
I think you do have to separate the issue of why we're in Afghanistan and the mission there, and also what we're doing in Iraq from incidents like this, because I don't think there's a direct correlation. But, you know, it's absolutely appalling what's happened. You know, I think it's something where, you know, very serious questions need to be asked about not just the involvement of the people that seem to have been caught doing this, but the fact that many other people seem to have turned a blind eye to it, or the fact that superiors didn't know what was going on or weren't interested in the fact these things were going on. And yeah, like you say, I mean, it's certainly not the way to win hearts and minds, and you know, it's very damaging to the cause. But I do think it's a bit of a separate issue. I mean, this is basically criminal activity. This is not military action here. These are people acting completely outside their remit, and, you know, murderers and rapists and
one wonders, though, if they hadn't been stupid enough to film it and pass it around to their friends, then maybe nothing would have happened.
But I think that just shows, yeah, it shows the sort of the callousness, but also, yeah, it's almost like a psychopath would do, you know, to be just so totally at ease with what you're doing.
But there must be a sort of culture over there of this thing being allowable if they don't even realise it's supposed to be secret.
Yeah. Well, I think it's like when we saw with some of the filming at Abu Ghraib, yeah, there were people where it was, you know, accepted that it was okay to completely humiliate prisoners and that. And this seems like a similar sort of scenario. And actually, it's something you get in this country. You know, I've been talking to people recently about young men sexually assaulting, you know, girls the same age as them, and, you know, filming things on their mobile and putting it on YouTube. And it's the same sort of thing. It comes back to the idea, yeah, that they don't see that there's anything particularly wrong with what they're doing, and it's partly about having complete contempt for the people, you know, for their victims, whether it's because, you know, just because they're female in this country, or whether it's because they're Afghanistan's and whatever. So, you know, I think it is horrendous, but you know, although I don't agree with the death penalty, so I don't agree with what the man on the film clip Glenn was just saying, you know, I do think it's something that you know, they need to be brought to justice and treated very severely.
Martin, what about you?
Well, obviously, this is, as Kerry says, is criminal rather than military activity. It still does beg the question about what we're doing in Afghanistan, which is a wider issue.
Well, we're there to stop terrorists, terrorists to send over here.
I mean, I don't really want to go into... I mean, I'm opposed to us being in Afghanistan. Let's put that... I mean, I don't think there's any secret about that. Like most of the British public, when we've done petitions about this in Bristol, all sections of the community have been, including military people, have been largely opposed. I mean, I was chatting to a guy who fought in Afghanistan in Birmingham last week, a couple of weeks ago, British Special Forces. He's totally disillusioned with the mission, and I think many of the British soldiers out there are disillusioned with the mission. Those are wider questions. I think dealing with people who behave... I mean, this is absolutely undermining of any possible strategy that the British might be trying to pursue, or the Americans in Afghanistan. But what really worries me is we've got basically a secret gulag out there with thousands of people disappeared into it. We know they're being tortured. There's got to be either a rule of law or no rule of law. We know that Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan has been used for torture. There's massive evidence to suggest that. And, you know, many young Afghans are very angry about foreigners being in their country, and they're fighting with them.
Okay, a final story this week. And now this is something which quite shocked me. It's a consultation going on under everything in local government. Everything is under threat, it's called. And there are all sorts of different responsibilities of local authorities which are now under consultation. Unfortunately, the consultation finishes on Easter Monday in a couple of days' time. And it started on March the 17th, but I hadn't heard anything about it. It's called the Local Government Decentralisation Tackling Burdens Review of Statutory Duties. And some of the statutory duties, of which there are about 1,300 which are being reviewed right now, include whether local authorities should make provision for the purposes of extinguishing fires and protecting life and property, whether local government should make provision for the purpose of rescuing people in the event of road accidents, whether local authorities should make provision for chemical, biological, radiological or nuclear emergencies, or even enter into and give effect to reinforcement schemes with other fire rescue authorities. Now, it sounds like some pretty critical stuff is being reviewed here, Kerry. Had you heard about this? I certainly hadn't.
Not the specific local government one. I mean, I know certainly there's been a lot of spin at government level about, you know, they see that almost everything that government does as they class everything as a regulatory burden. So when they talk about all these health and safety laws, they're talking about things like minimum wage and that. There's definitely concern amongst environmental groups that at a national level, all the environmental legislation is being put into this basket, and people are, you know, that's being put up for grabs, and that may be revoked as well.
Martin, just in a few words.
I think they've got to be, the Conservative government has got to remember the old Conservative slogan, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. People voted for David Cameron for steady as she goes, not for a great big scramble, as we're getting.
Well, thanks to this week's guest, Labour MP for Bristol East and Shadow Treasury Minister Kerry McCarthy. After the news, Russia and China kick up a fuss about NATO military advisers and drones going in and mission creep in Libya.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in